So I grew up in Yugoslavia, in the part that's now Slovenia.
Right.
So subconsciously, I was always affected by international economics because, you know, kind of growing up, it was pretty obvious that life of people right across the border was very different from life that I experienced in Yugoslavia. However,
over the past 30 years, the world has seen a dramatic opening up of markets to international trade. And for the most part, it's been a boon to many developing economies, but it has not benefited everyone.
I mean, is it fair to say that there are winners and losers?
Yes, absolutely. There are winners and losers. My name is Nina Pauchnik, and I'm a professor of economics at Dartmouth College.
Nina Pauchnik has become a leading researcher on the ways international trade has affected the poor, for better and for worse.
So, those questions were always of interest to me because at the end of the day, we want trade not just to improve opportunities for companies, but ultimately we want it to, we want to understand how it affects the lives of the people. The theory seems to suggest, oh, it's going to be great for everybody, but that doesn't turn out to be the case.
Not always.
Not always.
Journalist Rhoda Metcalf sat down with Nina Pauchnik to talk about her research and why she chose to make international trade and trade policy the focus of her work.
You've done a lot of research that's really dug down into some of the most crucial social justice questions surrounding freer markets and international trade. After all this research that you've done, what have you come to believe? In developing nations, are the poor better off when their country opens up markets?
There's no simple answer to that question. People always ask, is trade good for the poor? And we would love to have simple answers, but that's just not how it works. So, when I was in college and people were thinking about, how does trade between rich and poor countries affect poverty? The solutions were kind of easy, but they were all based on predictions of economic theory. So it would, raise average incomes, reduce poverty, and reduce income inequality.
So it's going to be great for everybody.
Yes. And what has been really exciting in economics research over the last 25 years is that we have actually been able to look into these questions with much more detailed data than was available in the past. And the answers to, is trade good to the poor and how does trade affect inequality is much, much more nuanced and kind of depends on the context.
I mean, is it fair to say that there are winners and losers?
Yes, absolutely. There are winners and losers.
So who, give us an example. I mean, you spent a lot of time studying Vietnam, right? So who would be on the losing side in a country like Vietnam when markets start opening up?
Vietnam was a very poor country in the 90s, and it started opening up and also started moving from very kind of command-controlled economy toward more market-based economy.
Right.
And, one of the key trade agreements that Vietnam signed as part of that process was that Vietnamese exports gained access to U.S. markets. And, U.S. is really, really important export destination because it's a really rich, large country.
Right.
Definitely people in living in provinces that were where more export-oriented industries were located, that were closer to the larger ports in Vietnam, benefited more. During this time period, Vietnam was actually growing really fast. So poverty was declining everywhere, but it was declining more in these particular areas. But it was declining, for example, less in areas where more minorities live, like in more mountainous areas in northeast. But given that it was during this time period was such a fast-growing economy, it's harder to notice who are the people who are actually losing during this time. But once the growth slowing down, that becomes more apparent.
Right. And so I guess it's also a question of inequality, too. It's just that
yes,
some people have really gained and other people haven't moved.
Yes. And, and the one thing that, worked in Vietnam's favor during this process is that it had a relatively young population. It was also a relatively well-educated population for a country at its level of income. And it's also, geographically, it's a very narrow country. So all these factors contributed to the fact that like it was much easier to move from more rural areas of Vietnam to like more urban areas of Vietnam where these export opportunities were presenting themselves. So for all that, those reasons, you know, we need to be careful not to extrapolate what happened in Vietnam to other contexts where, you know, countries are much more remote, their population is older and less educated.
Right. Because as I understand it, I mean, research has also shown that in some countries like India, opening up to international trade has actually made some of their people worse off, right?
Yeah. So India had a very large trade liberalization in 1991. And what India's liberalization did is lowered tariffs on imports coming into India. And like Vietnam during that time, during the period of trade liberalization, you know, India was a growing country, so poverty in general was declining. But what research work by Petya Topalova, who's actually at the IMF, found is that, you know, different districts in India, especially in rural areas, were differentially affected by this trade liberalization. In particular, if you're an individual living in a district with where high concentration of industries that were competing with imports, poverty in those districts actually decreased less. In those districts, also agricultural wages decreased relative to other parts of India, and industry wages decreased as well.
Why would wages come down?
Wages would come down because the demand for workers living in, you know, in this local labor markets decreased because, you know, companies faced more competition from abroad. And so there was less demand for work from the domestic companies that now, you know, had to lower their prices and reduce production. You know, and so you might kind of wonder, well, you know, export opportunities were created in other parts of India, so why don't people move, right? And what's interesting is that, you know, what a lot of the empirical work has shown is that people just don't move as much, especially out of areas that were negatively hit by trade liberalizations. And that's the case both in country like United States. We have research now showing that areas that were negatively hit by Chinese competition in the 90s and early 2000s also stagnated and became worse off, and people were not moving out of those areas. And you find similar evidence, you know, in India, and then also in country like Brazil, and not just India. So it seems to be a regularity. And then the reasons for why people are not moving, you know, some of it is related to poverty, right? Moving is costly, so poorer people cannot cover those costs of mobility.
Because you can imagine, especially in a developing country, and also if you're poor in North America, the fact that you survive is based on the fact that you live in a family and there's a collective resources there. You have somewhere to eat, you have somewhere to sleep. You move away and suddenly you're on your own. Who's going to help you when you move to this new region?
Yep, that's exactly the case, because people rely on kind of informal social networks, including castes, to receive kind of social insurance. So, for example, if you are sick or if you need childcare, you rely on a caste and your family. And that, you know, if you move away, you lose these important social networks, and you know, you might not cope as well with kind of negative events in your life. That's why, you know, in countries that have better developed social insurance systems, moving is easier because you don't rely as much on your family or kind of your local community to provide these sort of services.
Is there any kind of a gender divide in terms of the way that global trade affects countries? I mean, do men and women, are they equally affected by, you know, the changes in their economy based on these more open markets?
That's an excellent question. And it's also a question that hasn't been explored as much in the past, but there's a lot of exciting ongoing work. One of the actually my own ongoing projects is, again, I'm looking in Vietnam, where we are trying to see, like, you know, where exactly these companies arrive and how many jobs they created across different areas of Vietnam. And then we are trying to link that to employment opportunities of young individuals, especially women. And then also trying to link that to decisions about schooling and marriage and, you know, childbearing. And it's still very much work in progress. But what we have found is that, you know, the arrival of these jobs doesn't actually change whether or not a woman in Vietnam is employed. However, it changes the type of job that she has. And in particular, Women are less likely to work in agriculture, and they are more likely to work in manufacturing. And what we are in the process of trying to do now is see how, you know, how is this affecting the marriage decisions and having children. And some of the preliminary results suggest it's delaying both of these. And that seems to be consistent with the work that some other researchers have been doing in China, where they're also finding delays in marriage and delays in childbearing.
So I'm interested. I mean, a lot of economists look at the questions of international trade, globalization, but you seem to have really focused a lot on kind of the more vulnerable people in society, the poor, the children. What brought you to that focus? And did you always want to be an economist?
No. I only realized I wanted to be an economist in college. So I grew up in Yugoslavia, in the part that's now Slovenia.
Right.
And right on the border with Italy. So kind of subconsciously, I was always affected by international economics because, you know, kind of growing up, it was pretty obvious that, you know, life of people right across the border was very different from life that I experienced in Yugoslavia.
Sure.
However, I didn't really know how to understand that, right? Like, why is the country poorer? Why are other countries richer? And how does international trade affect that? I went to the United States in 1989 to spend a year with my relatives in Minnesota. And up to then, I really didn't take any social science classes because right. If you're a good student in Yugoslavia, you basically, they trapped you into natural science and kind of math high schools. In Minnesota, I actually had to take a course in social sciences, and I discovered economics as part of that course. And I had a really inspiring teacher, Mr. Munich.
Nice.
And because of that, I then ended up taking a course in college in economics and then really realized, wow, economics enables me to better understand what's happening in the society at large, including, you know, why my life in Yugoslavia was different from a life of, you know, a child in Italy at that time.
On the other side of the border.
On the other side of the border, yes. Right. So when I was in college, large changes were happening. You know, Berlin Wall fell right before that. You know, Yugoslavia was disintegrating. So I was, you know, just through my life, I became more interested in social science questions, and economics provided a way to do that.
Sure. But why this focus that you have on international trade and poverty, international trade and inequality, what has steered you in that direction?
I think in part because, you know, when I was taking classes, everybody was emphasizing the benefits of international trade. And I also believe that there are a lot of benefits to international trade. When I started doing my research, I started focusing on, you know, how does international trade make companies more efficient? And one of the channels was, well, inefficient companies go bankrupt. But then I kept wondering, well, what happens to people that lose jobs? So, kind of my next papers were then kind of looking at, you know, well, how does international trade and opening up of the economies affect workers? Or you then start wondering, well, if people lose jobs, like how does that, or if trade creates jobs for parents, well, how does that affect decisions that families make in investing in their children? So, those questions were always of interest to me because at the end of the day, like, you know, we want trade not just to improve opportunities for companies, but ultimately we want it to, you know, we want to understand how it affects the lives of the people. The theory seems to suggest, oh, it's going to be great for everybody, but that doesn't turn out to be the case.
Not always.
Not always, yeah.
So you were just mentioning something. You were talking about parents and decisions for children. And another area that you've focused on has been child labor, which is, I think, is a very interesting topic. It's also a very emotional topic for a lot of people. Now, why did you want to dive into that question?
You know, as a consumer, like in the 90s and the early 2000s, you know, one thing that we all had in mind is like if I'm buying Nike shoes or like a cheap T-shirt from Bangladesh or China, is it being produced by a child that a lot of the anti-sweatshop groups were showing, you know, on TV or ads and so on? That affects you, right? Like, you know, am I actually causing that child labor when I buy a T-shirt from a lower income country that doesn't have the same labor market regulation that we do in the United States? So again, I was interested in this question, and we started digging in the data. And what the most important thing to realize is when you look at, like, you know, where are the children that work, what are the children that are working doing? Most of them are actually working in unpaid work, hand in hand with their parents. So either on a family farm or in a kind of small family business.
So it's not so much the predominance of child labor is not in factories, but is in some kind of a home operation.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, why do parents want to send their children to work?
Yeah.
It's an unfortunate consequence of poverty. You know, most parents want their children to do well, and that means, like, they want to send them to school. But unfortunately, when you're a poor family, you sometimes have to make really, really difficult choices. And sometimes you cannot afford to send children to school, either because you need to rely on their paid or unpaid work, or you can't pay schooling fees. So what the research has found is in kind of low-income countries, when you're thinking about, like, how could international trade affect child labor, it really will depend a lot on how does it affect the incomes of families where these children live.
So things like sanctions. I mean, people, there have been groups, organizations that have called for sanctions against countries that allow child labor. What is your sense from your research as to whether it is a useful thing? And would sanctions bring down child labor?
Based on what we know about child labor, you know, most situations, sanctions will not necessarily reduce child labor. In fact, they might actually lead to increases in child labor if they cut off, like, a primary income source for parents.
Right.
And, you know, even if you sanction child labor and don't allow it in kind of the most visible forms of child labor, for example, like manufacturing firms, you know, you need to kind of ask yourself, like, what will these children be doing in the absence of ability to work in manufacturing plants, let's say? And sometimes what would end up happening is they might actually end up going to worse forms of child labor that might be less visible to international consumers. And if the reason for a child's work is poverty, they're not going to be going to school.
Right, because that's a big question, right? It's that, you know, if they're not working, what are they doing? Does that mean that they've now been put into school by their parents?
Absolutely. You know, even though images of child labor are really difficult to observe, we do need to think about, you know, why are these children working? And oftentimes these children are working because, you know, they unfortunately live in poor families.
Right.
That is not to say, though, that, like, there is no need for sanctions. And, like, you know, in some areas where there is actually child exploitation and kind of worse forms of child labor, those are the places where, you know, the role of sanctions is actually more important, because even though, like, sometimes that is associated with poverty, there are other forces at play that could be dealt with sanctions.
Do you have any sense that there are solutions out there? Are there ways to encourage poor families to allow their kids to work less and be able to get an education? I mean, are there examples of that?
Yeah, so in some of the work I've done with co-authors in India, what we have actually found is that the reason why children were being held back from school when families face these declines in income and increases in poverty as a result of import competition were schooling costs. Because what we found is that when poverty increased in these families, children did not go to school, but they also did not work in market work that generated income. They were either kind of helping with family chores at home, or they were idle, neither going to school nor working as a primary activity, because families couldn't afford the schooling costs. And what we found is that in areas where schooling costs were lower, perhaps because the government was offering free midday meals, which reduced the cost of going to school, these negative consequences of import competition on schooling were actually smaller. And, you know, the cost of this sort of, like, direct subsidy to a family is potentially easier to finance than, you know, like, some larger scale project.
Right. So perhaps instead of putting in sanctions, you put in some kind of a motivating factor that makes it more economically viable for parents to send their kids to school.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know, you really kind of, like, you know, what research kind of gets at, you know, what's the main reason why children are not going to school? Here it was, you know, poverty combined with schooling costs. So then you know how to address that problem.
Oh, that's interesting. So coming back to the original question, which is, how do you feel now about buying products? Does child labor come into your mind at all when you buy stuff?
I will admit I buy a lot of fair trade products, in part because I believe in kind of social justice issues, but we do not have good evidence that they actually provide the large-scale solution to addressing issues such as child labor.
But do you think that buying products, shoes or clothes from these countries where there is child labor, do you think that that somehow feeds into more child labor?
I do not think so, because you know the main channel through which child labor is affected through international trade is family income. And to the extent that families are benefiting as a result of increased export opportunities in countries like Bangladesh or Vietnam, that will trickle down to less child labor and more schooling for their children.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So, Nina Pouchnik, I really appreciate you coming on. This is a fascinating conversation that we've had, and I look forward to hearing more about the work that you do in the future.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Rhoda Metcalf speaking with Nina Pouchnik, professor of economics and international studies at Dartmouth College. The June 2023 edition of Finance and Development magazine is all about trade and the impact of international trade policies. Check it out at imf.org/FND. And go to imf.org/podcasts or wherever you listen to hear more of these podcasts. I'm Bruce Edwards.
And I'm Rhoda Metcalf. Thanks for listening.